writing for people within the corporate sector. And I feel as though your book goes right to the heart of that. What is business journalism? What is it? What should it be, Dean?
Right. I mean, I'm sad to hear that those were the only choices that you were given. Business journalism is, of course, all of that. It's reporting for investors. It's exploring the merits and demerits of consumer products for consumers. It's offering technical advice for people who in specialized fields. But of course, business news affects everyone. Business affects everyone. It has a huge impact on society and vice versa. I mean, they're so interconnected. We learned this from the financial crisis. So of course, you have to broaden pull the camera back and broaden the frame, and business news has to encompass all of those things, plus where business fits into government and society, and how it impacts all of us. And that was the key ingredient that was missing in the run up to the financial crisis, as we'll explore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we are going to go to the Palace of Pledge in about 30 seconds, but I want to flesh this out for people really quickly. We're live on the phone with Dean Starkman. He has been writing these fascinating blogs for the Columbia Journalism Review about all aspects of what's happening in the media right now. And something that I want to talk about a little bit later is also a blog post that he just did a few weeks ago showing how digitized media in the example of New Orleans, NOLA.com, actually has possibly, as, according to this investigation, resulted in squishier news, less informative news. And I want to take this opportunity to go to Rabia and Victoria to explain to you, our beloved community here, why are we here?
Well, we're here to make sure that you get to hear this kind of radio, and you can help us make sure you hear this kind of radio by calling us at 877-500-5266. Yes, on the air at KBOO.FM. You can sign up online that way. So give us a call, support talk radio that brings you more than just chit-chat or bombast. Talk radio that actually give you information about what's going on. It's interesting that Lisa is interviewing a author who writes for the Columbia Journalism Review. I said, wow, Columbia Journalism Review. I subscribed to that for a couple of years. That's like reading The Atlantic. And what I mean by that is that every single article is well-written, and these are magazines that you keep for years, because if you don't get through and look at every single thing, you've missed out. And you'll miss out unless you call us, 877-500-5266. Support Lisa's efforts.
Absolutely true, Victoria. It's great to be here this morning. This is Ani. And it's wonderful to be starting off the day by asking you right now to stop what you're doing and consider community radio as a part of your life. You know that you listen every morning to get your news, to get your information, to really feel connected to your community, as you can with our talk radio shows, 8 to 9 a.m. every weekday morning. It is the voice of the community, really here talking to each other, broadening the discourse, and that is the value of community radio. Please call right now and let us know that you're there and that you care and that you are wanting to be one of our fiscal sponsors.
Dude, also get
877-500-5266.
Get a copy of the book, Dean Starkman's book, The Watch Dog That Didn't Bark. We're offering you a copy of this book for a $60 minimum pledge. That's only $5 a month. That's less than the cost of a half rack of PBR a month, okay? And it's good for your head. This is the kind of information that, you know, with KBOO, we toss a stone into a pond and it makes ripples, and that's how change happens. This is the kind of book that has the information in it that you can get. You read the book, you give it to your mom or your uncle, they talk to other people about it. That's KBOO, that's community, that's how it works around here. 877-500-5266.
or online at kboo.fm. It's so important that we do hear from you now because, in fact, we are here in the midst of our winter membership drive. Our membership drives, they're our way of really giving you the opportunity to join us, to actually participate in independent media. It's how we draw attention to the fact that we're a little bit different here. We don't rely on commercials.
We're radical.
We're radical. We are To the Root Radio, right? And we want you to be a part of that because, in fact, it's a wonderful opportunity to actually do something that makes a difference for your entire community.
To the Root. I love the To the Root. Okay, I'm dragging this back. I'm saying 877-500-5266. Come in person. We are at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon. We love it when people come in person. I'm Lisa Loving. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. It's our gorgeous membership drive. We're live on the phone with one of the coolest guests ever, Dean Starkman. Okay, Dean, we got some real estate now. Let's stretch our legs out. Tell me about this book. What the hell happened with that financial crisis, and why did all those business reporters not let us know what was happening? Or is that what happened?
I'm afraid that is what happened. I mean, the title of the book is The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, and, you know, I wanted to establish a couple of things. One is that there actually was and is and potentially can be a potent watchdog in the public interest, and the tragedy of it was that it went silent during the critical years leading up to the crash of 2008. I did a study and read basically the content, the prominent content of 9 business publications, all the ones you're familiar with, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Fortune, New York Times, etc. And we're just looking for stories that essentially did what journalism's core function is, which is to hold the powerful institutions to account at a time when they're still powerful. And it's interesting that some reporters were able to do that. There was a line of reporting that was able to delve into and discuss and reveal actually the serious corruption that had overtaken the financial system. The problem was that they didn't work for these large mainstream news organizations. They mostly worked in the alternative press, and that was sort of a tragedy. And I want to say that to those listeners and, you know, in Portland, and you know, your audience might be skeptical that that big news organizations are capable of really confronting powerful institutions. And if that's how you feel, and I don't blame anyone for holding that view, but I actually urge you to buy the book because I demonstrate that actually it can be a really potent force for reform. It just tragically wasn't employed during the critical years that when it was needed.
Mm. And actually, I mean, it is really interesting. You're also really digging heavily into the trends of what has happened with media over the past, well, as you're pointing it out, I mean, it has been a generation. We have seen the downturn of newspapers coming from about 10 miles away. But like when media doesn't often cover itself, that's why it's such a joy to have you on the air, Dean. But I mean, so looking at these issues here in Portland now, we don't have, in Oregon, we don't have a daily newspaper anymore. The Oregonian went the way of NOLA, right? They're owned by Advanced Publications. Same thing. So, we're talking about the book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. We're talking specifically about how it is that the financial crisis happened. This, I mean, I'm going to say corporate theft at the topmost levels of United States and world financial systems, without our, you know, the Wall Street Journal, what have you, really letting people know what was happening. And yet, this is something that's playing out on every level in media today. And so, Dean, January 14th, you did a fascinating column for The Audit, which is in Columbia Journalism Review, about tracking digital era news quality declines. Talk about what happened with this Tulane University student project tracking the Times-Picayune, right? Times-Picayune, also owned by the same corporation as owns the Oregonian. Now, this is a mainstream newspaper. It's really old, and people love that paper. You know, you could complain about how the Oregonian covers things, or even how the Times-Picayune has covered things in the past, but when Hurricane Katrina hit, those reporters stayed in the Times-Picayune building, and they would not leave, and they kept covering it. So sometimes we're looking at what's wrong and what's right, but talk about that a little bit. Talk about that particular story, Dean. What's going on with the digitized media?
That's a great question, and that's right. I realize, of course, that Advanced Publications also owns the Oregonian, as it does the Times-Picayune and the Star-Ledger in Newark and other, and the Plain Dealer in Cleveland, and tragically other papers. What's going on is that the Advanced Publications, which is owned by Condé Nast, the big New York media concern, is off on a disastrous course. It's trying to It's trying to basically fit a 10-pound news organization into a 5-pound digital bag. It's abandoned any hope of sustaining the print edition, which is where all the money has come from. Essentially, it's pulling the plug on print to a large degree, and it's trying to make its way solely on the basis of digital ads. Well, the problem with that is that digital ads comes from high traffic, and high traffic comes from high volume of stories and posts, meaning that the quality of posts is really not the main issue. It's just the number of them. So what you're going to be seeing in Portland is what you have been seeing in New Orleans, is that the news cycle, the news productivity machine gets cranked up, all in a search for more clicks and more higher traffic volume, just to try and generate digital ad revenue. And this has predictably disastrous effect on the quality of the local report.
Now, when you did your column about this Tulane University student project that researched the headlines, they were specifically looking at now, and I know people that read Oregon Live, I'm just going to say this, I know great people over there at the Oregonian, right, at Oregon Live. I don't even want to trash them at all. There's some fabulous, right, people carrying a lot of water over there, and we're all looking around and going, what the heck is going on? But you, right, kicked this study back to the Times-Picayune publisher man guy people. What did they say?
Yeah, I mean, it's really just to speak to the Oregonian reporters and the rest. I mean, it's not about individual reporters and the effort they're putting out. I mean, that's been one of the main reasons I wrote the book. It's really about big structural questions. Do these news organizations provide the environment, the infrastructure, the support to do great journalism, which is really what all reporters want to do and basically what all readers want to read? What you're asking is what the study found, and essentially what everyone sort of felt intuitively in New Orleans was, wait, you know, the Times-Picayune wasn't perfect back in the day, and it certainly has declined because of staffing cuts in the last few years. But something really changed when Advanced Publications went over to this pure digital model based solely on the amount of digital ads it could generate. And so what they wanted to do is, can we somehow track quality differentiation between one period and the other, 2011 in this case, and 2013. The dividing line was 2012. And, you know, and the study, you know, it's a student project. It's not peer reviewed. It's not hard science, but it really was a game effort, a thorough effort at trying to compare the two eras. And, you know, what you found really most interestingly was, first, there was an enormous, you know, increase in the amount of what they called and defined, I think, properly as soft news, basically sports, entertainment, and stuff that just really didn't require a lot of time to prepare. And what was really fascinating was the new incarnation of the Times-Picayune found fewer sources per story.
That really worried me a lot. That one worried me.
Yeah, of course. It's not like a perfect metric, but it's a good one because it just sort of speaks to this idea of how much time are you spending preparing this report? How deeply have you gotten into it? How many people have you talked to? You know, how broad is your knowledge before you hit publish? And you know, that was sort of a telling stat. And what was sort of, you know, really troubling about it was, it was true, you know, across platforms. In other words, you know, the 2011 Times-Picayune had, you know, 3+ sources per story, and the 2013 version had just about 2. And that was true in the paper, on the website, on the tablet, and in the iPhone incarnation. So really all what was happening was, you know, really is, it's not definitive. I'm not pretending this is, you know, this was some sort of last word on the subject, but it really points to just this, you know, a troubling decline in just the basic quality of the news, the care used in preparing the news. And I think that's what, you know, people intuitively sense, and it really has does a lot of damage, you know, both within the community and you know, in the readership at large.
Now, Dean, in like 1 minute, we're going to go back to the Palace of Pledge, and I just want to establish this in people's minds. Though, we're live on the phone with Dean Starkman. His newest book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism. We're going to dig into the specifics of this book in a few minutes, but we're talking about how the Newhouse family that owns the Times-Picayune, the Oregonian, the Newhouse family owns Advanced Publications, and they are a billion-dollar empire. It's like $7.5 billion. That was back in the late 80s. I'd love to see someone coming out with a new biography of the Newhouse family and how much money they're making by squishing down the news and basically turning it into an exercise in bean counting. That's our biggest concern. Now, we are going to go back to the Palace of Pledge, but I want you listeners, look, we really need you to step up. I know that other people are having their membership drive right now, but this is KBOO. We're the grassroots. Rootiest, and for a $5 pledge a month, $5 minimum pledge a month, that's $60 a year, you get a copy of The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. You give us a call, 877-500-5266. We give you a gift right now, and then we love you for the rest of the year. And so Victoria and Ani are going to tell you guys about it.
Thank you, Lisa. Yes, this is Ani. I'm here with Victoria. And in fact, this is the thing that we are going to tell you about. It's joining community radio. It's your opportunity to participate in independent media so that you can be a part of that, of the independent press. We are that watchdog, right? And I think that it's so important to look at the value that community radio brings you with deep investigative reports, with bringing voices to the air this morning, just like Dean Starkman and all of the people that Lisa has had on over the last 6 months or so. If you think about it, we are that independent press that allows you to get behind the scenes, to really think about unpopular and controversial opinions and news stories, and we serve it all up for you. We do it because we are independent, and we are independent because of your support. 877-500-5266. It's the number to call this morning to join us and help us reach a $1,000 goal before 9 o'clock. We can do it with your help, and with your pledge of support of $60 or more, you can get a copy of this book, just like Lisa was saying, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis, and the Disappearance of Investigative Reporting. It's so important to get informed, don't you think, Victoria?
Well, the thing is people think, well, what is investigative reporting? It is going behind the headlines. It is going down to the seedbed that developed, that created the conditions that led to the behavior, that led to the sometimes corruption, sometimes something else that we don't find so pleasant out in our world. And if people aren't looking carefully at the background, you really don't understand. That's one of the things I've said repeatedly about KBOO. Oh, by the way, I'll give that phone number one more time, 877-500-5266, or go online, kboo.fm. One of the things KBOO does is trains citizen journalists, and it's a unique role that KBOO plays in our broader community. There is no other station in the state that does what we do. Even our sister stations in the community radio network in Oregon don't do this. They use news off the line. And I don't knock it. I think Al Jazeera, the English language broadcast, is just great, and I get a great perspective. BBC is a great perspective. But if you want to know about local news, regional news, Oregon news, that is looking at issues that other organizations are not taking the time to look at, you've got to go to KBOO.
You know what else, Victoria and Ani? You know what else, since you brought it up, okay? My name's Lisa. I'm a KBOO volunteer. When you call 877-500-5266, you make a contribution to this radio station, guess where some of that money goes? It goes into all the equipment and stuff that we use for free trainings. You know, I was listening to NPR last night, and I was listening to Robert Smith reporting live from Sochi. That guy started at KBOO. NPR reporter, so many have. And you know what about him back in the late 80s? Always with a suit and tie, okay? Now you go and check him out on the NPR website, looks like a hippie. I'm just saying, so many people get their start here. Professional journalists get their start at KBOO, where we give free training, and you cannot shake a stick at that. If you do, I will chastise you. But 877-500-5266 to support this. Like I said, it's the stone in the pond and the ripples that go.
It is so true, Lisa. I mean, what you're saying about us being a training ground, that is one of the very important things that KBOO does. It's part of our program charter to make sure that people who are underserved or unserved in corporate media are able to actually come in and take the training to become the media, right? And that is what we do. We provide that platform for people from the community to share our stories stories, to share our truths, to be investigative reporters, and to get the word out, to spread the information and broaden the public discourse. That's what you're a part of. That's what you're supporting with your pennies, nickels, and dimes at 877-500-5266. Think about joining at $5 a month. Do a monthly contribution. I always like to recommend people join at an hour's wage a month. You know, like if you make $10 an hour, join us at $10 a month. It's a great way to even out that responsibility throughout the community and to make sure that KBOO stays healthy and financially independent into the future. 877-500-5266. You know what's really cool is we have investigative reporting teams now looking
yeah,
at
a
whole
a
lot
grant.
Of different...
And we got a
yes,
grant.
That's it.
We're legitimate.
Well, and it's a grant to actually have our investigative reporters look at the effects of ALEC on Oregon legislation.
Oh, what's ALEC, people are saying?
Oh, well, what is ALEC?
American Legislative Exchange. It's, again, this corporate sector, some people would say, corporate sector control over our electoral process. So when you're listening to KBOO, we're just asking people to give us a contribution. We're passing the hat. We love it when people come in person. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland. Come in, put some money on the table. This is what you're supporting. This is, you know, there's other community radio stations, there's other public radio stations, but KBOO is the grassrootiest, really. We really need this place. And again, 877-500-5266, online, kboo.fm, or come in person. We got some hot coffee. We are at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon. I'm bringing this back. I'm shaking Dean. What's going on, man?
Yep.
And we are encouraging people to get active in supporting the media that that the communities need. Dean, how did these issues around the financial crisis and the disappearance of investigative journalism, how did the public play into that? Does the public have a role in that? Does the public, like, I know that at the Oregonian and other media outlets, there's a sense that really what people want is entertainment. They don't really want news. So what's the public's culpability in that, or do you see one?
I don't. I know that there's sort of a school of thought that somehow the public missed the boat or wasn't responsive to the reporting that was supposedly done. But that's one of the reasons I did the original study, one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I actually have a great faith in the public and actually great faith in journalism that once the story is told the right way, the public will respond. And it's happening. It's been proven over and over again. It's not about public apathy or public laziness or public this or that. I mean, people are really hungry for real information. You know, your listeners are. I mean, that's why they tune you in. I mean, you know, people are. You know, it's a complete fallacy that somehow that people don't care, that they don't want to know. You know, that they aren't curious about powerful institutions that affect their lives. It's just sort of bogus on its face. Mm-hmm. So I reject that argument entirely, and I feel like it's also a kind of an attempt by journalists and journalism to abdicate their responsibility to go out and get that story.
Mm. Or as we, you know, where I work, we're always pushing back and arguing with the publisher about what should or shouldn't be published, and we want longer stories. You know, I mean, the reporting people, we want longer stories, and he's like, no, it's too long. Sometimes it's all about trying to literally figure out the sweet spot where the money flows in, to be honest with you. And that's what I think a lot of people in the public don't. I don't know. It's a business, not a public service thing. And there's a place where that sort of, there's a tear that rips apart. People assume that the Washington Post's job is to let them know that the president is cheating. But the Washington
right.
Post assumes that its job is to make money.
That's a really fascinating point, and of course there's a real tension there that you're sort of getting to, and I mean here's the thing. The old model, you know, for most of the 20th century basically entailed a huge subsidy for public interest reporting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the connection between public interest reporting and money has always been sort of tenuous. The fact is that regional papers, including the Oregonian, the Times-Picayune, the Tribune in Chicago, et cetera, the Charlotte Observer. These were quasi-monopolies. And basically, if you had, and basically, they had monopolies over not readers, really, but the advertising market in their community. So if you wanted to advertise, you know, your used car or your grocery store chain or your department store, you kind of had one or two places to go, and you basically had to go to the paper. I mean, that made money just flow into these companies. And some of them, you know, didn't use it particularly wisely. Most of them were obscenely profitable for many, you know, for too long. But in fact, there's sort of residual, one of the residual, like, happy consequences of this was large newsrooms staffed by numerous reporters, many of them with lots of time on their hands to do great work. And that's sort of what we're trying to figure out now, right? That model, you know, of course, is sort of in free fall. And we're sort of scrambling to figure it out. Like, wait, we kind of took all this public interest stuff for granted. Mm-hmm. Now we don't. You know, now it's basically its subsidy has disappeared. You know, what do we do? And that's sort of where we're at.
It's true, and I have to say that I work in a newspaper, and sometimes it just feels like we've been downsized so much, and there's so much more going on. And because of the digitization, we all do twice as much stuff. I mean, everyone in the entire right. building does twice as much. It's just like I Love Lucy in the Bon Bon Factory. Did right. you ever remember? Did anybody watch I Love Lucy? And there's an assembly line, and the lady keeps speeding up the assembly line, and pretty soon Lucy and Ethel, there's chocolate everywhere. They're sticking it in their shirt. That's what it feels like some days. And
the
I just
is trouble is. In this case, it's actually, you know, it's not funny. I mean,
it really
affects the, you know, not just the lives of the working journalists, which is of course important, but not the main issue. It really affects the quality of the local report, the depth to which local newspapers can dig into big investigations and the important issues that they have to pass up because there's no time to get into them.
It affects people's daily life and having as. As we're sitting here, we're talking about this. I do want to call out Oregon Live. I want to call out Betsy Hammond right now. She's an investigative reporter over at the Oregonian, and you need to be reading her series this week about absenteeism in the schools and why does Oregon have one of the top dropout rates in the country. I mean, it's a kick-ass report, and she's rolling it out for the whole week. So I have to call right. that out and say, go read that. But I want to come back to Dean and say, Dean, one of the parts, one of the things I love about The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, your newest book, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism, is you roll out history on some of this stuff. So right. can I ask you, like, so you're talking about the rise of accountability reporting, talking about Ida Tarbell, talking about the roots of business news and the birth of the Wall Street Journal, and then talking about the rise of the great story. So I want to backtrack a little and say, I know a little bit about Ida Tarbell and the history of muckraking, but I've never heard the roots of business news and the birth of the Wall Street Journal. How did those papers, how did that come about?
Yeah, that's an interesting, I was trying to figure out, okay, why did some reporters, you know, get the story during the run-up to the crisis and others didn't? I thought actually the answer lay back in the DNA of business news. And in fact, it's kind of true. I mean, business news started as basically these were what I call intra-market messaging services. They basically started in the late 19th century. They were wire services that were kind of camped out around the New York Stock Exchange. And essentially what they did was, you know, they employed literally messenger boys, young boys to carry pieces of paper with bits of news from corporations to the marketplace and back. And that was sort of so they weren't really so much reporting on the system. They were almost part of the system. And they're one of the reasons that Dow Jones, that later became a publishing giant and publisher of the Wall Street Journal and this dominant news organization, one of the reasons it survived among all of these was that first they had a clever distribution system where they invented a pen that could make 36 copies at a time so they could get the news out faster. And secondly, they have a very good journalist named Edward Jones, and his main job was to get scoops from Wall Street executives and those types in a bar near the exchange. And so my point being that the very roots of business journalism has always been what I call access reporting, getting access to powerful people and institutions to find out what they're about to do. And I thought that was, and again, there's actually nothing particularly wrong with that form of reporting, but I thought we needed to make some distinctions at this point, you know, in our history, and figure out, like, okay, access reporting is valuable on a one level in sort of narrow ways, but really it's accountability reporting, a completely different practice, a whole different approach to the news that you know, really gets to the bottom of complex problems. And that's why I wanted to draw those distinctions between those two types of reporting.
It's interesting because you're sort of talking about the fourth estate and the fifth estate, as we know those phrases. You know, the fourth estate sort of considered to be like government is considered to have three estates, and the fourth estate is like the one that is sort of unofficially in a way part of government, but we don't often look at it that way, and it's considered to be the mainstream news media. And then the fifth estate, as people describe this, is like you're saying, the accountability reporting. It's fascinating. I never thought of it that way, access versus accountability. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I mean, you could ask fairly, like, why am I writing about Ida Tarbell when in a book about the financial crisis? Of course, the answer is that she faced the same journalism problem that we did in the mortgage era. And the problem is, you know, how do you explain complex problems to a mass audience? In her time, you know, the complex problem was industrial consolidation, monopoly, John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil Company, the Beef Trust, the Steel Trust, all these conglomerates that were basically controlling both the economy and the political system. In our era, the complex problem was financialization. What she did, and what makes her so special in her magazine, McClure, so special, was they invented almost a new journalism form, basically the investigative narrative, that really, you know, what was this kind of experiment that first started to be published in 1902 and extended through 19 installments through 1904, really sort of ignited the country. You know, it really it mobilized the public and brought them out. The way I sort of see it is they sort of brought them in on the game and explained to them, okay, this is how this giant monopoly came to control 90% of the oil market. And that's, you know, that's really what we're looking for, and that's what was so, you know, sorely missing during the mortgage era. If we had
the modern mortgage era now.
And that kind of report, you know, that at least the public would have had a fighting chance to be in on the problem and maybe have a hand in helping to solve it.
Mm. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're live on the phone with Dean Starkman. We're talking about his newest book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism. And you were just talking about Ida Tarbell and the rise of what we call the muckrakers. I want to ask you this. One of the things that's super fascinating to me, one of my personal biggest issues right now is Google, the Google Corporation. I personally feel that it's a monopoly. They are sort of escaped a bullet, as they say, in Europe, in the European courts this past week, where they've been charged repeatedly with antitrust. And I feel as though the way that we understand Google, the Google Corporation, is really it's undermining our democratic institutions all over the world, in my personal opinion. I don't see any intelligent coverage of that really anywhere. That's the one that really worries me the most. And their motto, of course, is don't be evil. Okay. So, but one of the things that's interesting about Ida Tarbell also, who was my super favorite? Another female investigative reporter who would go and get jobs places and then write about it. Why can't I think of her name? And then there was the man that wrote the.
You're not thinking of Nellie Bly.
I'm thinking of Nellie Bly.
Who posed as a mental patient to expose horrible abuses
in a mental
at a hospital on the current Roosevelt Island in New York. Yeah, that was one of those astounding work that was being done. It was being done so long ago.
100 years ago, maybe more than 100 years ago now. And I'm just going to say women in corsets putting themselves out, Ida Tarbell doing stuff like that. It's a little different even than what we see Betsy Hammond doing at the Oregonian. She's a math whiz. Love math. Anyway, but the other big piece that I'm thinking of, the Muckraker era, and then I'm going to make the point here, was The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. He wrote a novel about abuses in the Chicago meatpacking industry, and yet it's considered to be a classic in reporting. And what these people did, it's like exactly what you just said, Dean. They took these stories and they put it at the people level. Right? So that people could see themselves in the stories. Now, I want to ask you, Dean, do you think it matters the size or the platform that these reporters used? I mean, because I do know bloggers and, again, the Fifth Estate, people picking away at these stories, but they don't get the same traction.
Right. That's such an important question. It's such a, you know, it's such a puzzle. I think it does matter. There's been some interesting work done on studying the internet. A guy named Matthew Hindman and others have sort of shown that really the internet it sort of looked to be this this potent democratizing force, not just politically but also for speech in the media. But just the structure of the internet is essentially. And as you mentioned, Google and the technical structure of search has sort of wound up that basically the blogs and the sites that dominate the internet are basically mainstream news organizations and a handful of bloggers, but basically there's this huge
It's like a barrier block of a handful of things,
and then there's no middle-sized blogs, and everything else is basically ignored. So it's so important because it doesn't matter what the platform is. If the work is great, you know, won't it find its audience? And the answer, I think, is actually no, not necessarily. I mean, it may in the future, and we may be getting there. But I mean, one of the things that was so frustrating about the reporting that I was looking at during the run-up to the mortgage crisis, one of the best things that was written on Citigroup, which is really one of the biggest players in the crisis to come, and both on the lending level and in the derivatives market. One of the best reports was done by a tiny magazine called Southern Exposure that might have had 3,000 readers.
Southern Exposure, we've heard of it. Yeah. Dean, I have to grab the talking stick.
Yeah.
I have to grab the talking stick and give it back to Victoria and Ani and say, look, people, this is the membership drive for our mighty, tiny, mighty KBOO.FM, and this is the time for you listeners to invest in reporting that makes your life better, and media, music, all the things we do. And Victoria and Ani are going to tell you how.
Well, you can just pick up that telephone and call us at 877-500-5266. Or if you're listening online, and a bunch of our listeners are, in other words, even though we are just in this little location, a physical place in Portland, we're reaching people literally all over North America.
We're everywhere.
Yes, so KBOO.FM, and you can sign up there. It's been a growing part of our membership base, and by the way, it's our listeners who fund us, not advertising corporations. We're not the supermarket to the world or any of that kind of stuff. We need you who are listening. If you've listened to Lisa before, you know that she always brings you interesting stuff in an interesting way.
Yay!
Well, and as Dean Starkman just noted, she asks important questions. This is what Lisa does.
What?
You do. You ask very important questions.
It was a question. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, that wasn't your most important question, perhaps. But you do ask important questions, and that is the thing, because your questions tend to, they're there to broaden the public discourse, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we do here as your community radio station. We get people talking. That's our job. Because, you know, we don't really leave it to the hands of experts. All these complicated social problems, all these things that need our attention. You know, if we left it to the hands of the experts, well, nothing gets done, right?
No, this is about you listeners being the experts now.
Exactly. And because we get that information out there, you take it, you share it, you talk with your friends, with your coworkers, with your family. And this is the way that we actually, within our communities, develop solutions, develop new ideas, develop ways to actually affect social change.
877-500-5266. If you don't call that number, we're going to hear dead air.
Well, and it would be awfully sad.
No, do call, because, and also come in person, because everybody's here at the Membership Drive. I love the Membership Drive. We're at 20 Southeast 8th in Portland, Oregon. This is maybe one of the only radio stations you could just walk into and shake people's hands. I'm just putting that out.
And we love to meet our listeners. You are a part of the community, right? You're a very important part of our community. You are KBOO. And this is a labor of love by so many volunteers and so many listeners putting our resources together. And the way that you do it is 877 877- 800-500-5266.
Oh, and beyond that, it's not a labor of love. It's a labor of loving. Ms. Lisa
She's
Loving.
She's saying that. It's my, it is sad. Today is my wedding anniversary. It's true. Everyone in my family gets married around Valentine's Day. Don't ask me when they get divorced. That's fine. But I'm just saying. So it's KBOO. It's our happy drive. Come in person. We're real people. We're here doing stuff. We're volunteering. Join our community. 877-500-5266. Come in person to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. I'm going to bring it back, and we're going to go get Dean Starkman. And I'm sorry.
Wait, Lisa. No, I got to say thank you. Pine State Biscuits brought us our breakfast, and it was fabulous. I just had some of their biscuits and gravy. They are located at 2204 Northeast Alberta. Thank you, Pine State Biscuits.
And Cannon's Rib Express at 5410 Northeast 33rd Avenue, and Handsome Pizza, 2730 Northeast Killingsworth. We thank all of our food donors for, in fact, feeding our volunteers today. We'd love to thank you with your call at 877-500-5266. That support, it's so important for community radio. You are what keeps us independent. It is your time to shine. 877-500-5266.
Hey, and coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, we're speaking with educator, writer, and activist Mike Rose about his book, Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us. At 10 is Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert talk February gardening tasks, including a discussion on pruning grapes and kiwis. Kiwis. Plus, ever thought of growing citrus in Portland? You can, and Jim will tell you how. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live on the phone with Dean Starkman. Stutter. We're talking about his newest book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark. Dean, I could talk with you all day. It's amazing. And it's interesting that we're talking about this book during the membership drive, because we have to, because when we're looking at what do consumers need in terms of media, sometimes what consumers need to do, or, you know, I don't know, sometimes we create our own. And I don't even know. Dean, now I just want to cut to the chase and say, what do you see for the future? Now, I've read so many of your columns, super and incredibly informative on CJR. .org. But Dean, where is this all headed?
Yeah, I mean, first we have to figure out sort of where we are, and where we are is really in a bad place. I mean, what's happened was the last decade, basically the newspaper industry, the American newspaper industry, is basically the backbone of our news gathering system. It's gone from a $50 billion business to a $25 billion business, and you know, in droves of reporters are out on the street, or NPR are doing something else. So we just have to first recognize that we're below where we need to be. I mean, state house press offices around the country are basically wastelands. There's nobody there. The problems, we're not where we need to be. So now we look at the landscape of new entrants, and you know, there's a lot of excitement in my world, the space I sort of occupy, about new digital entities coming to the fore and actually succeeding. So there's Vox Media, just hired Ezra Klein from the New York Times. There's BuzzFeed, which is drawing traffic hand over fist. You know, there's Huffington Post, sort of the grand old lady of the digital era. But the thing to sort of recognize is that these are still relatively small organizations. Most of them are about the size of what would be a sort of mid-sized regional paper in the past, and there are only a handful of them. Secondly, especially when you're talking about BuzzFeed or Business Insider or Gawker or that type of outfit, is that the amount of accountability reporting that they produce is actually rather small. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying we're talking about, you know, what I describe the difference as being between journalism on an artisanal scale and versus an industrial scale. And that's what it was in the past, and that's where we sort of have to get back to. So, I mean, I can't say, you know, I'm like overflowing with confidence and optimism about where the news is headed. One of the reasons I wrote the book was I at least wanted for us to sort of agree, okay, what's the main priority? What's sort of job one for American journalism? Then we can figure out how to go get it. And I think we're sort of, you know, starting to, I hope at least, sort of coming to a consensus that we need, you know, that accountability reporting is sort of job one, and we have to figure out how to fund it.
Mm. the funding. It's interesting because here in Portland, there's a national nonprofit called the Journalism Accelerator with my esteemed colleague, Lisa Scooby, over there. And they have been spending the past 3 years literally trying to use the tools of MBAs, use the tools of business to understand what's happening with the media trend. And so it's interesting, though, because I feel like sometimes the biggest obstacle in a way, and Lisa might disagree with me about this, is the reporters themselves. I mean, we don't want to look at what we do as something quantifiable like a business. And yet this is, unfortunately for everyone, it's a business environment. And that kind of, I have to say, we're getting to the top of the hour. That brings me back to the business of the KBOO membership drive here. And we are going to come back to Dean in just a couple of minutes, but we have to make the rain happen. Okay. So people make it rain.
Okay, 877-500-5266. And, you know, if you were to sign up now to pay us $75 you get a exclusive content available only on KBOO's USB flash drive. And we just got a late-breaking bit that all the audio from yesterday's special, The Day We Fight Back, will be on the flash drive that we're offering this membership drive. If you missed the special yesterday, you can hear it all by getting the flash drive as a thank you gift for $75.
Also, for a $60 contribution, you get the watchdog that didn't bark. And everything we're talking about that you can get, 877-500-5266. It's not just about you. Think about who you're going to share it with. I'm putting that out.
It's so true, because we are about sharing information. We are about spreading the news and news you can use to actually, you know, make relevant decisions, to live an informed life where you can take right action, where you can be a part of social change, where you can take responsibility in your community for helping make the world just a little bit better. And it all starts with you dial in right now, 877-500-5266, and becoming a member of KBOO this morning. There are so many ways you can become a member. You can bring your credit card to the phone and do a one-time contribution. You can set it up in a monthly electronic fund transfer from your checking account to ours and sort of balance your budget all year round. I know that's the method I do. I've been doing that since the late 90s, and I do contribute an hour's wage every month. And as I do that, I know that I'm able to give far more in the course of a year than I would ever be able to come up with at any one time, right? And so it works really well for me. It'll work really well for the community radio station, and I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say it's going to work very well for you. Consider right now what you might afford every month. I really do recommend that hour's wage, don't you, Lisa? You do.
She does.
Because we used to say this shtick together all the time. So 877-500-5266 is the number to call, and you can contribute an hour's wage every month.
Yay!
Evening out the responsibility throughout
do
the
it,
community.
Do it.
And
70, I knew she gets excited about
and
that.
And $75. Now you probably wonder, well, what else is on that flash drive besides yesterday's all day special programming? You can also hear discussions, interviews with, guess what? Margaret Mead. This is from the KBOO Archive. Ken Kesey. Ernest Kallenbach.
The KBOO Archives are amazing.
It's like E.B. Dubois in 1964. We've got that in our archive. Dick Gregory. Ward Churchill, Stokely Carmichael, lots of folks that you haven't had a chance to hear in a
Eldridge
long time.
Eldridge Cleaver. I mean, we got really amazing people on this. We also have three albums of newly released songs from David Rovics, a Portland-based folk singer, internationally renowned social change singer, and also a toolkit of open source software for internet security. It's all there on this flash drive that we've prepared for you for your $75 contribution.
By
you can break
calling.
That up into $6.25 a month.
Seven, 500, 5266.
And also, just like Lisa was saying, we also have this watchdog that didn't bark, the financial crisis and the disappearance of investigative journalism.
This is a really good book. I'm putting that out. It's really a great book. It's got a lot of history in it. Again,
you're hearing the interview right now with Dean Starkman and Lisa. You're hearing about the importance of independent press in the role of living informed lives, of actually being able to see what's going on so we can do something. This is important material, and you can get this book for $60 right now when you call as your thank you gift, 877-500-5266. Online, you can go to kboo.fm.
And you can get the flash drive. You can get the book. Hey, you know,
But you always get KABU, and that's the deal. KABU is your real thank you gift, right? You know that you are an important part, a contributing member, not a spectator any further. You are actually making it happen your very own self, and that feels pretty good. You can take this action first thing this morning, feel great about the rest of your day. 877-500-5266.
And you can sleep really well tonight knowing that your conscience is clear that you made that move to be part of the 10% of our listening audience that manages to sign on up.
I wanted to say to Ani and Victoria, we do have just a couple minutes left in this happy break before we go back to Dean. But, this is investment. And we're on the phone with Dean Starkman. We're talking about his book. And a lot of times in KABU, we're an alternative community. So we don't believe in commercialization and corporatization. But, dude, it is an investment. And you know what? You invest even if you don't think you are, right? Whatever you're spending your money on, that's an investment. You give KABU some money, 877-500-5266. You know what? That's some money that's not going to go to the war. That money, you make that investment in your community. It stays here, okay? It doesn't go to the, Texas corporate repository. Like so much of that investment does go. And so you're giving people an opportunity to get free training in media, to go out and perpetrate more media. It's just a win-win-win-win. And so I just have to say it again, really encourage people to come in person to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. You can come right in here. You know what? You can meet me. My name is Lisa Loving. You can meet the magical engineering pixie and the studio dog. Meet us all. You know, so many mornings, it's us and Kathleen Stevenson and nobody else in this building. And that's what I love about the membership drive. People come. They come in. Love it if you came in. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. You know, I'm going to cycle through these contact informations really quick so that we can have a few minutes left with Dean. 877-500-5266. $60 contribution gets you this awesome book that you can share with all kinds of people. A lot of people are joining online, KBOO.FM. And that's where you can share the podcast of all these shows, even the music shows, for a period of 2 weeks with people that you care about anywhere in the world. And now KABU's become 24/7. We need you to make an investment in this station. So is it okay if we come back to Dean?
Well, you bet.
Right on. And thanks for all the people that called. Dean, look, few more minutes left. We've covered a lot of ground, but there's so much that we haven't had a chance to talk about. I really wish that we could have had more time to talk about the specifics of the subprime right. lending. I mean, that right there, that was such a red flag. I have to say, one thing that interests me about this is that years ago, I did a report about Fannie Mae, okay? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about this. When I did this report about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, while they were sort of giving more home loans in inner north and northeast Portland than anybody else was, the growth in black homeownership in that period was 0%. When I did this series, I ended up with 5 people from Fannie Mae on the phone with me at once. It was as if it was almost like a public information. It was like the PR people that were more like the mafia. I mean, talk about this a little bit. Were there other factors that tamped down the reporting?
That's really a great question. Yeah, I mean, right now that's sort of what shows you what reporters are up against. And they are basically taking on huge, powerful institutions, whether it's Fannie Mae or Goldman Sachs, and you know that's why you need strong and robust news organizations to sort of fund and provide the environment that allows this. There's so much. There was sort of a perfect storm of bad news going on for the press during the mortgage era, including, we have to say the Bush administration's deregulation campaign really sort of took the air out of a lot of investigative reporting and didn't give the usual sort of pushback. And also, there was a loss of confidence in news organizations as their own finances were sort of unraveling. So accountability reporting, as you know, it's like so hard. It takes so long. It requires enormous risk, and it really stresses a news organization. There's so many reasons not to do it, and yet that's sort of the main thing that the public needs. And so, there's so many things that militate against it, and yet we all have to find ways to make sure it keeps going.
Okay, Dean, we have a minute left, 2 minutes left. What are you working on now? What are you looking at now? Where should we be looking?
Yeah, I thought it's interesting. I'm trying to. People have asked me. You sort of told us what we need and what we actually, you know, what's important going forward, but how do we get there? How do we fund it? And I've actually started to sort of think about the problem of sustainable economic models for news organizations that both do great public interest reporting and also be commercially viable. And I think that's sort of the, like I hope you guys are, whether it's through you know, membership models or subscription models or sponsorship or something. But there's got to be a way, because right now we're really not at, you know, in a good place. We have to find a way to sort of grow our news gathering capability, and that's sort of what I'm really thinking about these days.
All right. And I just want to let people know one more time that this is the KBOO Membership Drive. We are wrapping up this show. We do have a copy. We have copies of Dean Starkman's excellent book, The Watchdog That Didn't Bark, The Financial Crisis and the Disappearance of Investigative Journalism. This is a book that you're going to enjoy. It's got a lot of history in it. And that's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Dean Starkman. More on his work at deanstarkman.com and cjr.org. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. This show will be podcast on KBOO.fm by the end of today. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Hey, March 4th is coming up. You better be ready. Dean, thank you so much for being with us. It was really a pleasure. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
The sixth extinction. Scientists across the globe are monitoring its progress right now. You remember the fifth, don't you? When the impact of an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs and two-thirds of life on this planet? This time the culprit is us. Human activity has sped up the rate of extinction to match catastrophes of the past. Join me, Linda Olsen-Osterlund, for a membership drive edition of A Deeper Look. My guest is award-winning author and staff writer for The New Yorker, Elizabeth Colbert. We'll talk about her fascinating new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. That's A Deeper Look this coming Thursday morning, February 13th at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
And you are listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. Coming right up this morning, we're going to speak with educator, writer, and activist Mike Rose about his book, Why School? Reclaiming Education for All of Us. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, we've got The Dirt Bag, host Glenn Andreessen and his guest Jim Gilbert talk February gardening tasks, including a discussion on pruning grapes and kiwis. Plus, ever thought of growing citrus in Portland? You can, and Jim will tell you how. Right now, we're going to join Kathleen and her guest, Mike Rose. Kathleen?
Thank you, Tammy. Why does school matter? That's a question that Mike Rose, my guest today, has looked at from many different angles. How should we think about school, success, and opportunity in a democratic society? What does it mean to be educated? These are just a few of the questions posed in this book. Mike Rose is currently a member of the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies faculty. He's taught in a range of schools and educational and training programs, from kindergarten to adult literacy, over the past 40 years, and he is the author of a number of books, including Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education, Lives on the Boundary, The Struggles and Achievements of America's Underprepared, and The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. His book, Why School: Reclaiming Education for All of Us, is just out in a revised and updated edition. Mike Rose, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Tell us a little bit about why you wrote Why School.
Well, there's lots of reasons, I guess, but the big one, you know, is this, that if you look at the way we have been talking about school over the last couple decades, the way our legislators have talked about school, the way our major policy documents have defined school, it pretty much boils down to this. We send kids to school, or we go back to school ourselves, for one reason only, and that's to get a better job and to kind of help the broader economic social order. So that's it. That's the justification. Now, that's always been an important reason to go to school, and I'm a working class kid, so I certainly appreciate what school was able to do for me in terms of economic mobility. So going to school to get a job and become part of the economic order, that's important in the United States. But there's so many other reasons that parents send their kids to school or that we go back to school, and I wrote the book to try and remind us about that. So, geez, I mean, think about it. For example, parents will send their kids to school because they want them to develop interests. They want them to learn how to get along with others. They want them to learn to think with others and solve problems with others. They want them to learn how to learn. They want them to grow into decent people. And when you talk to folks who are going back to school, even after being out for a long time, and they're going back for, you know, pretty specific economic reasons, they want to try and get a leg up. Even they, Kathleen, will tell you, well, you know, I'm going back too because I want to learn new things, or I want to be able to help my kids with their homework, or, gosh, you know, I've never been able to read or write very well, or I've never been able to speak really well, and I want to get better at doing that. So even folks who are going back to school for really, you know, powerful economic reasons have so many other reasons as well. We just don't hear any of this. So That's the main reason why I wrote Why School.
Right. And you yourself have had powerful interactions, or more than one probably, but one that you write about with teachers. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's influenced what you've done with your life?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. You know, I think I ended up doing what I'm doing because it was a teacher who turned my life around. I was, you know, as I mentioned a moment ago, I grew up in a poor family. None of my forebears went to college. I mean, only about three of the folks in my family even graduated from high school. So, you know, this was not familiar territory to me. And to be honest, I kind of drifted through school. I wasn't a particularly distinguished student at all, and the same all the way through high school, just kind of floating along. And then in my senior year, as just sheer dumb luck would have it, I got this young English teacher who worked us like dogs, and somehow or another he just caught my fancy. And he was the person that asked me one day where I was going to go to college, and I said, I haven't even thought about